So, Jan, thank you for being here. Very excited to have you.
Thanks for inviting me.
A lot of stuff to cover. We may also be able to take some questions through the app or through the website, so sf.eaglobal.org/polls. I won't promise that I'll get to them, but we might have some time to do that. So I think that I first met you like 8 years ago, and at the time you had sort of, well, much more recently, certainly relative to now, wrapped up your involvement with Skype. And you gave a talk at an old Singularity Summit event, and you said, I find myself in the kind of unusual position of trying to figure out what to do, knowing that I've just kind of wrapped up what is probably going to be the most successful project that I'll ever do. And that is a unique challenge, but you've really made the most of that opportunity and have engaged in a lot of really interesting things over the last 8 years that have spanned AI and other existential risks, some work on global coordination, some interest in a whole bunch of different companies. So I want to give you a chance to kind of talk about all of that sort of stuff. But let's start off with just kind of a little bit of a retrospective on the last 8 years since you first got involved. Like, how have things gone from your perspective, and how have they kind of deviated from what you thought might happen?
I'm not sure I remember like how much I thought what will happen. Yeah, things have gone really well with one exception. Like things that have gone well is that like the EA movement has scaled. Probably the most important thing is that so-called Overton window, things that are acceptable to talk about now firmly includes at least some version of AI safety. So you can actually kind of publicly talk about without being ostracized. Yeah, there's much more people, much more talent, much more resources, money available in existential risk ecosystem in general, and more organizations, et cetera. So like things are really growing really, really nicely. I think the main exception is that we still have like a lot of uncertainty how much time we have. So it's like great progress against unknown deadline.
From the very beginning, you were really worried about the kind of Yudkowsky-style scenario of, a fast takeoff or things getting out of control quickly. Have your views on that changed over the last 8 years?
I mean, a little bit. Well, I guess like they have like diversified or gotten more uncertain over time as like more thoughtful people have entered the AI safety space. There are basically more hypotheses or more views about what might happen and what might be important. And my general approach is to basically look at when people are making thoughtful arguments and see whether there's where I can find a bug in them. If I can't find a bug, then I just like say, okay, here's some probability mass for you. Therefore, like, yeah, as people have made these plausible arguments, I have increased my uncertainty over a process. For example, like, I'm kind of a little bit missing the days when it was just like one fairly crisp idea what might go wrong. So I just recently funded a project in Berkeley that is trying to reconciliate different ideas or different hypotheses how things might develop so we could have a better, more hopefully more compact idea what's going to go on, what's going to happen.
I think one way that you have always stood out is in your epistemic modesty. I mean, here going back to 2010, you're this very successful person. You've had this great, visible company that's made this impact on the world. And when I first encountered you were kind of willing to spend time with anyone who had an interesting idea on AI, and it did not seem to matter to you what credentials they had or didn't have. But then at the same time, you've kind of used your own social capital to kind of take the best of that and try to take it to other places where maybe those, idea authors like wouldn't be welcome. So tell us a little bit about kind of your strategy for leveraging your own social capital, but being so humble at the same time.
One thing that I sometimes say that, there's like a really like nice benefits that you get from doing programming full time, and like one of them is that you get like an intuitive sense of what it means to have your thoughts fully specified, and that you can use it on your thoughts, you can use it in other arguments, like are they using just like vague metaphors to convey things, or are they actually something that potentially a machine could understand. So this is like useful when I wanted to sort of it's useful for epistemics. If I wanted to kind of evaluate arguments by a bunch of weird people in Singularity Institute, that really helped. And the other thing that programming gives you is indeed like epistemic humility, because programs, you're so confident that you know what's going to happen now, and then you press F5, and nope. And then you look at it, it's like, yeah, okay, clearly I made this mistake. You fix it. Nope, that still wasn't the case. So yeah, it creates like epistemic humility. And like when I kind of entered the kind of young ecosystem, I immediately kind of looked like, okay, so what are the things that I could contribute? Like after kind of trying to debug the arguments and finding that, okay, they seem to be solid. And indeed, I found that, okay, I do have this, as a side effect of my programming career, I picked up this brand that I can then like use by basically attaching the brand and my reputation to arguments that I believed that were true, but people needed some kind of brand to be attached to those in order to actually take them seriously. And that seemed to have worked pretty well. For example, Hugh Price, my co-founder at the Center of Study of Existential Risk in Cambridge, he has this written this New York Times piece. It was like, my road to existential risk, taxis in Copenhagen or something like that, where he kind of explicitly says that the reason why he started taking this seriously, even though he had heard those arguments like many times, was that, okay, somebody's really sort of has a reputation of being practical in software, actually takes those ideas seriously.
Were there some kind of very early fundamental arguments that persuaded you most, and do those still kind of hold a lot of weight in your mind mm-hmm. today?
Oh, absolutely. Like the main realization is the idea of recursive self-improvement. That, yeah, I think initially formulated by I.J. Goode in 1965. But I read it from what was Overcoming Bias when Eliezer Yudkowsky was writing there. And he was like making this argument in a very clear manner that I just bought into. And I still think that it's one possible way that how things could go massively wrong in the world, which just have an accident in an AI lab where you're pushing this like meta learning or whatnot, and suddenly the meta learning system starts to meta learn, and you have a system that you can't no longer turn off.
And so how has that kind of that seed view evolved? I mean, you've talked about kind of more different ways that things can go wrong. So now you have a richer view of that. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about kind of the more nuanced view.
So like one sort of competing theory is that the current deep learning framework might actually take us to the point where we have kind of systems that are roughly on human level or superhuman. But they still cannot understand themselves. They're still fairly opaque to themselves. Therefore, there's no immediate danger of sort of fast takeoff in a lab. But you still have a situation where there's a global instability because of suddenly humans are no longer the smartest planners on this planet, for example. I think it's more complicated, messy, less clearly defined scenario, but I do think it's plausible, and so I'm assigning some probability mass to that.
And you're involved now with a number of different organizations as an advisor, in some mm-hmm. cases as a funder. Give us a little sense of kind of your portfolio of activity across the the AI space with the different organizations and sort of strategies that you're involved with?
Yeah, so my strategy over the last 10 years or so has been to cultivate diversity in the ecosystem, in the sense of if I basically see that there are some smart and what's now called aligned people, and they want to contribute to existential risk reduction, what I've done is like, okay, here's some seed money, and then like if they stay around and start growing and becoming productive, then I have just like increased the amounts of funding that I support, like, support them with. So yeah, like over the 10 years or so, I've been contributing to something like between 10 and 20 different organizations and projects in this space. And now recently, starting last year, I thought that I should kind of really start scaling up. Sort of one half-joking way to say it is that I assign very significant probability to human economy not surviving the introduction of human-level AI, meaning that there's no point in accumulating maximizing the amount of money that you have at the point at the point when money becomes meaningless. So I need to kind of look at like how much time do I have to spend this. I mean, obviously it's like, again, it's still possible that economy, something that resembles human economy, will continue after that, but I don't see why. I might be wrong. So it means that indeed I have to scale up my giving. And so I've been working with Barry, existence.org, with Critch, who's sitting right there, and seeing like how can we institutionalize me for some for some value of making. Critch put it yesterday, like in a way nice, that Barry was originally conceived to help various X-risk institutions. And then I approached Barry with the thought that, okay, perhaps you can help me. I said, Chris was, oh yeah, Jan is like an institution. Okay, so I'm qualified.
So you've put a lot of energy, highly intentionally, into moving the Overton window, as we were talking about it, around what mm-hmm. kind of thoughts or worries are kind of okay to have. Going back, 8 to 10 years, it was just too weird for anybody who was a respectable, tenured computer science professor, even in the AI space, yep. to have worries about things going wrong. That seems to have shifted in a big way. Where do you see the Overton window being today? And do you think that work is done? Has it shifted enough, or is there more to do?
It seems to me that the Overton window right now caps out at technological unemployment. So like the weirdest thing that you can talk about when it comes to AI in a respectable setting is societal effects.
This is, of course, not a respectable setting.
No, it's not. Yeah, by respectable setting, I mean people who are mostly concerned about looking respectable and thinking about what optimizing the opinion of others. I would really like to push the Overton window higher by having the realization or the topic of AI as AI that might have effect beyond social stuff enter the Overton window. So I've been pushing it in a way that I've been saying that AI would be an environmental risk. Because first of all, I think it is an environmental risk eventually. But there's the nice thing about environmental risks is that these are things that kind of unify humans. Like we have we're very picky about our environment. Just change it by 100 degrees, which is like tiny compared to astronomical, like this way or that way, and we go extinct in a matter of minutes. And AI doesn't care about the environment. Like, why should it preserve the parameters? But the nice thing about it is that indeed, if there was a realization that, wait a minute, we need to control AI in order to not lose the environment, then this is like a much more tangible thing to have like a global discussion about. Whereas like if you just talk about social issues, for example, in the Asilomar principles that we did last year, there is this like very contentious principle about human rights, which actually kind of automatically precludes the Chinese to join the principles. So, however, if AI was about long-term environmental effects, there would be no problem of bringing everybody on board.
That's fascinating. So you're going around giving a lot of talks on the subject, kind mm-hmm. of trying to find the right way to deliver the message so that it can be heard and that you seem just the right level of weird. And you mentioned China, and you said you were recently in China and gave a series of talks mm-hmm. there. So what's the report from China? Obviously, it's something, AI is something that Chinese government, Chinese society is really working on.
I had some, a few updates. One update was that, I grew up in a totalitarian regime, and basically I knew sort of what to expect, but I hadn't been to China for a decade, or to mainland China, actually. So one update was that actually it seemed much more freer place than the place I remember behind the Iron Curtain. So that was nice, I guess. Then another update was that their AI researchers, at least the ones that talked to, they're like very kind of heads down, optimizing the classifiers and robotics, doing robotics, things like that. So it's like kind of, and they were kind of even like proud to say that we are very practical here. Now, on the other hand, there was like a really interesting appetite about talking kind of long-term philosophical manifestations of AI, which was surprising, even to the level that I don't see much in the West, or like people are more careful about saying in West. So that was interesting. Sort of half jokingly, like the world that I kind of in my talks I kind of pushed nudged a little, because I don't know if that's a good idea or not, but I think it might be an interesting idea that to have China as the grown up in the room, because like they kind of take really pride in saying that they're old civilization who thinks long term, as opposed to those like silly democratic countries who just like think 4 years at a time. There are like pros and cons obviously to that, but let's just exploit those pros and have them think like 5 or 6 years into the future and perhaps be like a couple of years ahead.
I think maybe the best piece that I've seen in the American kind of mainstream media about AI and the future of society was from a Chinese legal scholar who kind of mm-hmm. said, with a powerful AI, you might actually be able to have a planned economy that is effective, and you don't necessarily have to rely on market mechanisms, and you don't necessarily have to fall into a scenario where a few people sort of own all the data mm-hmm. in society, and we can actually kind of collectivize that and all share the benefits of it. Were these things you heard there?
I was aware of that. I did like a lot of preparation work when I went to China, so like I heard those things, but I probably heard it during my preparation work. But it's funny, actually. Yeah, like I've seen communism fail, and like the reason why it failed was people don't like to work. So like if you have like AI doing all the work, you don't have that problem for communism, at least. You might have other problems, but at least this particular very crucial problem you'll eliminate.
So in terms of we've covered a lot of your kind of personal and reputational efforts to move the window and get people thinking in new ways, and you've also been supporting a lot of organizations. What kinds of organizations are you supporting? Do you think about investing in for-profits, non-profits, a mix? Do you care? What kind of organizations are you looking to support?
Almost entirely non-profits. I think that, it's like a basic computer science realization that when you have two optimization targets, then you're not going to be great on either one. So like if you want to like optimize for the good of the world and for profits, then like you have to like trade off one of those. So I think the maximum effectiveness would be from there, effective altruist organizations or non-profits that don't have these constraints in profit. So interestingly, for example, also the same applies to Okay, think about like if there's a startup whose business plan is to do like a bunch of fundamental physics and then use those fundamental results from fundamental physics research to gain a commercial advantage. It would just sound silly. However, that is like very typical pitch from AGI companies, that they're going to use the, do this fundamental AI research and then use those results to get a commercial advantage, which like almost never works. Like when you start doing that, you immediately get this like tension. So I think the most successful AI companies in capabilities-wise, therefore, have been either in academia or in teams in academia, or just kind of like nicely cordoned off sections of like big companies that have lots of cash. So yeah.
How about what's going on in your own home country of Estonia? I mean, I'm hearing more about great companies being built there. Obviously, the Estonian government is known for being a technology leader. Do you think that Estonia has a role to play in this kind of AI future, given its unique position as a digital society?
Possibly, but I think it's, if then, mostly about the near-term issues about how do you integrate increasingly sophisticated technology. But I think that's like a fairly stark phase change when you go from like subhuman systems that are just really smart in certain domain to superhuman systems that might actually do their own technology development. And then like it's not clear that the work that has been spent on the shorter term problems immediately scale. Some of that might scale to the longer term, but it's not obvious.
Changing gears a little bit, you've also spoken quite a bit about global coordination as a challenge of interest to you. Just give us a little overview of kind of your interest in that topic and how you think about it.
Well, that would be like
2 minutes.
Yeah, that would be like 2 hours.
Yeah, maybe even just pointers to other places where people can go find more would be good as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking a little bit about like a little bit over many years now, so it's like very dilute thinking about there are things like kind of upcoming technologies that might make the coordination, global coordination, easier. And examples there are like the constant, like just we're going to get like a lot of data about what's happening on a planet, and people are already kind of using that to sort of weed out or find bad players. For example, in deforestation, it's kind of apparently it's harder to deforest the planet now than it was before the ubiquitous satellites. And blockchain is like kind of particular interest of mine. Turns out there are a few things that you can do. Like one way of putting it is that for the last 7-8 years, we have had a regime on a planet where it's possible to globally agree about a piece of data without trusting any central authority to maintain that data. So like, can we use that interesting property that the world has to come up with coordination regimes where, like in a situation where like you have participants that don't necessarily trust each other?
Google it for more. There's a lot more out there. A few questions coming in from the audience that are, I think, very interesting. How much, and that you're uniquely positioned to answer, how much do leaders of huge tech companies actually talk to each other?
I'm not actually sure.
Fair.
Yeah, I don't know.
I always appreciate your willingness to say, yeah, I don't know. What would you advise people to do who are interested in either earning to give to philanthropically support AI safety, or possibly trying to get more involved directly if they can? But let's just start with the money. Like, where is the best value per dollar right now in AI?
I'm not sure if Critch appreciates me saying that. But the thing is that the current situation we have in Berry, existence.org, is that I easily can't give more to them because that would be basically put me on like the fraction that I'm giving to them on a too big proportion. So like if I could have like other people join me, then that actually might be helpful. So that's one thing. I think just going to 80,000 hours and following their, I mean, they have done a lot of thinking about like how people can be useful. So like I think anything that I can say is going to be like kind of strictly inferior to what they have been saying.
How afraid do you find famous people to be about talking about issues that might be perceived as weird, even if they are important?
Huh. Really kind of depends on people, like, and how they have, what they are, kind of, what they have, what type of reputation they have to protect. If they're politicians, obviously, like, really careful about saying things. So, like, actually, like, yeah, my co-founder at Center for Study of Existential Risk, Lord Martin Rees, he's a politician. And it's, like, kind of fascinating to see how he kind of really cleverly balances the kind of craziness of the message that he's giving with a kind of optimized perception. So that is interesting.
Not sure if this one is right up your alley or not, but what do you think is the main bottleneck to increasing cryonics adoption? That was the first question.
Yeah. Main bottleneck. I might be wrong, but I think the main bottleneck is still that it's not sure if it works. There's like I do have investment in Nectown, which is sort of like competing with cryonics. They're doing like destructive brain preservation, and they say that I mean they have their bias to say that, but they say that look, the alcohol just like if you just look at scan in what they have been like post freezing brains, doesn't seem that there's much information there. But I mean, I don't have a lot of information. But indeed, like if there would be like much more higher confidence that this thing works, then hopefully it would kind of become more closer, a popular thing to do. But obviously, there are like many weird social blocks that also need to be overcome.
When you say destructive brain preservation, is that like slicing and scanning?
Yeah. Basically, they pump you full of cyanide and aldehydes and then like heavy metals to make your brain like high contrast, and then they freeze you. So like, there's no hope that they're gonna.
You're not coming back.
You're not coming back.
Not in the same form.
Not in the yeah. Basically, they preserve the information, not your brain.
We are very much running out of time, but maybe one last question. Beyond AI, which is obviously your number one mm-hmm. focus, are there other X risks that you see kind of rising to near that AI level in terms of urgency? Yeah. What are they, and are you involved?
Synthetic bio has always been a very close race with AI, like because it seems like much easier to use for destructive purposes, much cheaper. On the other hand, like it has this nice property that we can use intelligence to control it, whereas it's not clear if we can use that in AI case.
Jan Tallon, a philanthropist for our modern times, thank you very much. Round of
thank
applause.
You.
Thank you very much. Well, yeah.